So thanks a lot for being here so late in the day. I'll try to entertain you with black holes. And basically, I'm going to be taking a trip from astrophysics to particle physics and the Large Hadron Collider. So let's look back at, if we look back at the last 100 years of physics, we've been through an absolutely amazing time where lots of particles were being discovered lots of particles were discovered is what is called cosmic rays. So energetic particles coming from outer space and out of Earth hitting on stuff in our atmosphere and creating particles. And 100 years ago, people were discovering particles every day, basically like this, and it was essentially a big mess. And the question was, how do you fit this particle into some kind of pattern? So from this chaos and loads of new particles, we have now built the standard model of particle physics. And in this talk, basically, I'd like to show you how black holes could lead us to the next scientific revolution, solve some of the problems of the standard model. So long before we had a collider at CERN that you must have heard about, the Large Hadron Collider, we had already a collider with nature providing us with very energetic particles coming from the sun, from further away from the galactic center, for example, hitting on the Earth's atmosphere. So we're protected by a magnetic field, but still some of these particles can come through. They hit on the atmosphere. The particles in our atmosphere produce stuff. So we had ways to probe particles at high energy already. And by hitting on nuclei in the upper atmosphere, these cosmic rays produce loads of things like pions, kaon, and so on. So we had all these particles that were there, and it was very strange because there was apparently no pattern, no way to understand how these particles work together and how they would be unified into some kind of consistent theory. That's when people like Murray Gell-Mann understood that the concept of symmetry was crucial in physics. Symmetry basically means a pattern. And he found there was a way to organize this kaon and pion according to patterns and to assign numbers to these particles. And with a bit of thought, he came to the idea that you could build these particles from something more fundamental that we now call quarks, D, U, and S quarks. And with these patterns of quarks, you could rebuild all these composite objects, the kaon, the pion, and so on. And suddenly, there was order. All the particles that were discovered came from a few underlying particles that we could organize into patterns. Now, the way we like to think about, or the way we think about forces in particles is as of an exchange of a particle. That's a modern way to think of it. And you can think of two boats with two people exchange the ball. And by throwing the ball from one person to the other, you would have a force spreading the boats apart. And that's exactly the way we think of forces in nature. So there are four forces as far as we would know. There's a strong nuclear force. So to give you an idea of the magnitude of this strength, it's about order one. It needs some units. The electromagnetic force would be some 10 to minus 3 in these units. And the weak force is weaker, as its name says. And gravity, which is the force I'm most interested in, is much weaker. And that's also why it's more difficult to study, because it's so much weaker than the other forces of nature. So the standard model essentially can be cast into one slide. Those are the quarks I was mentioning to you that can basically explain all these mysterious particles that were discovered in the cosmic rays, including most of the things we can see in colliders nowadays. And then you have the leptons, which are also fundamental particles, and you have these force carriers, so the photon, the gluon, the Z, and W bosons. And more recently, we found the last part of this puzzle, the Higgs boson, and you can see that essentially this is an old slide because at that time we didn't know its mass. We now know that it's about 125 GeV. So the standard model in that sense is completed. And not being biased, being French, I would say it's like a perfect French recipe. You have spices that correspond to the weak force, the electromagnetic force, and the strong force. And these spices with the leptons and quark fit perfectly into a beautiful stew. The thing that is a bit odd here is gravity. And again, it doesn't fit nicely in that picture. And that tells us that this is not the end of the picture, that's not the end of the day. We still have some work to do. So just talking to politicians, things do take time. Between the moment the Higgs boson was discovered, or theoretically discovered, posited. And the moment was discovered in 2000, I can't remember, 2010, something like that. It was about 50 years. And Englert and Higgs got a Nobel Prize in 2013 for this discovery. So what is important to remember is that some people get the prize, but there were loads of people involved in the discovery. So in terms of theoretical particle physics, you had Keeble and two American colleagues, Englert and Brout, Higgs, obviously. Anderson had very similar ideas in condensed state physics, which is another branch of physics. And Brout, who unfortunately passed away before the prize was given, it would certainly have been on the ticket, used to spend a lot of time at Anderson's lab. And that's how he learned about the Higgs mechanism in a different setting and realized it could be applied into particle physics. So that emphasized the need for interdisciplinarity and for people to talk among the different fields of physics and beyond that as well. You can grab ideas from different fields. So as you were saying, the standard model works very well. What's next? What do we do next? So the answer is simple. There are many, many things we don't understand, and we have to remain modest. In the standard model, you have 28 parameters that we call fundamental constants that we cannot calculate from first principles. Those are parameters we need to measure, and that's just a sign that we don't have a theory. We have a way to calculate processes very, very precisely, but we don't understand things fundamentally. There's still a lot of work to be done. So in this talk, I'm going to focus on one of these constants, which is called the Planck scale, Planck mass sometimes, and it's related to Newton's constant, which is the coupling constant that fixes the strength of gravity that we've discussed a few minutes ago. And this is a scale, or this is the energy scale, that is really important for quantum gravity. It fixes the energy at which these quantum gravitational effects would become important. And that's important for black holes. That's why we're going to be talking about black holes. So the current understanding of physics is the following. We have these four forces, strong force, electromagnetism, weak force, and gravity. And we do physics at 10 to the 3 GeV maybe. And we see that these forces are very different from each another in terms of magnitude, in terms of strength. What we can extrapolate from what we're learning at colliders is that the electromagnetic force, the weak force, merge into some kind of electric force, and that's what we see in the Higgs mechanism. And we have good ideas that the strong force could merge with these forces into a ground unified theory. And only at this very high energy scale, so 10 to the 19 GeV, would gravity become comparable in strength to these other forces. And that would be one way to unify all these forces into one fundamental underlying theory with hopefully less parameters. Now, that's the classical way to think about it. One of the things we've learned in the last 15 years is that the scale at which gravity becomes comparable to the other scales of, to the other force of nature, could be much below that. And that's obviously very interesting. We're going to be using black holes to try to learn about that. So in that sense, the situation in theoretical physics is not very different from that of 100 years ago, when we were discovering new particles all the time. The situation is similar in the sense that we have a lot of things that we don't understand, a lot of parameters we don't understand. We don't have much data besides maybe dark matter and dark energy that are not explained by the standard model. But we have all these parameters that need to be understood. So we need new guiding principles. And again, we're going to try to use black holes to learn about that. So just to put things in perspective, this is a pyramid that shows the energy balance in the universe. What we see from the standard model, visible matter, is just the tip of the iceberg. We notice about 4% of atoms that we can't see but that are explained by the standard model. There's 25% of cold dark matter, that is a new form of matter that we have no clue about. And there's dark energy, which is 70% of the energy balance, that we can't explain either. It might be a constant, but in any case, it's not something that is described by the standard model. So just to, as a side remark, so dark matter is not explained by the standard model. We know it's out there because if we look, for example, at the way stars rotate far away in the galaxy curves, we would expect that because there's less matter, the velocity of the star that we see should drop as far as we go further from the center of the galaxy. And what we see is a plateau here. And so that's a strong sign of dark matter. And one reason why I'm mentioning this is that there are ideas that black holes could be a form or contribution to dark matter. So they may be part of this puzzle. So I've mentioned black holes several times now. The first thing I should do is to try to define it. And one of the things I've learned talking to astronomers in the last 5-6 years when I was focusing on this research topic is that the answer will depend on who you're talking to. So there's one definition on which I think everybody would agree. So a black hole is a region of space-time where gravity is so strong that light cannot escape from that region of space-time. And what's remarkable about that is that this idea was out there long before Einstein and GR and gravity. This idea was discovered about 100 years ago before Einstein wrote his theory of relativity by John Mitchell, who was a British cleric, and Laplace, who basically had the idea that light being composed, like Newton taught us, from photons, you could think of them as particles, and you could work out that there was a way for light to be confined and not to be able to escape from original space-time. So again, gravity would be strong, so strong that not even light could get out of that original space-time. So matter would be squeezed into this tiny original space-time. So we know that this could happen for stars dying. I think everybody agrees on that. But the problem, again, is because they don't emit light. By definition, there's no way to look at them. There's no way to see them. They're invisible. Now, that's a source of the problem, because astronomers want to study black holes. And what they call a black hole is not what I've just told you. For an astronomer, black hole is what they actually see. And what they see is the accretion disk around the black hole, potentially. So that would be matter turning around the black hole and emitting light. They might see a jet emitted from the black hole, but they're not talking about the thing that I'm really interested in, which is this that you can't see here, the black thing. So that's a problem for theorists and astronomers when you try to test your theory. What are we talking about? What is a black hole? And for a theorist, the situation is, again, a bit more complicated. And for us, a black hole is a solution to a complicated equation. It's a vacuum solution, so that means there's no matter, so there's no jet, there's no thing surrounding the black hole. And it's static, so that means it's time independent. So that's not really what astronomers would see in with their radio telescopes. So it's a very boring and simple object. It's defined by three things. Its mass, its charge, and the angular momentum. So we say it has no hair. Whatever falls into it leaves no trace. And whatever falls into that black hole, it remains to the black hole. Now, we've learned, thanks to Hawking, that this picture that is purely classical physics, where nothing would escape from the black hole, is not purely true. There's actually a radiation that is emitted by the black hole. It has a temperature. So that's why black holes, for theories, are a perfect way to try to understand unification physics, because it forces you to think about quantum mechanics and gravity together. You just can't ignore these effects. They have to be merged together and taken into account to try to make sense of things. So black holes have a temperature, and with this simple formula, you can see already why they're so fascinating. The temperature of a black hole that was calculated by Hawking relates Newton's constant, the mass of the black hole, Boltzmann constant, so you have gravity, you have thermodynamics, C, special relativity, H-bar quantum mechanics. All the fields of physics are in this equation. So you have to think about all of that in order to make calculations and make predictions. And they're strange objects. The heavier the black hole you make, the cooler it gets. So let me tell you a bit why things are interesting from a theorist's point of view. So we have two theories that don't match very well. Quantum mechanics, if you want loosely speaking the standard model, quantum field theory, and GR, general relativity. So quantum mechanics is really underlying all physical processes as far as we know it. It's a fundamental concept, and all the laws of nature should be quantum mechanical. The problem of quantum mechanics, or rather its feature, is that you can't make a precise prediction about what's going to happen. You only make predictions about the probability for something to happen. And we know that probabilities only make sense if when you add up all the probabilities for something to happen, that you should get a sum to be equal of 1. It's one of the things we first teach our students when we teach them quantum mechanics. So if you find a quantum theory where when you add up all the probabilities, you don't end up with 1, you have a problem. And we'll see that black holes can lead into this kind of problem. So in quantum theory, information is never really lost. If I collide two objects, I could have any kind of mess happening here. If I study precisely what comes out of this mess, I should be able to reconstruct what has collided. So information, in that sense, is conserved. Whatever goes into that region of space-time can be extrapolated from what comes out. So in GR, the situation is very different. So GR is the name of the theory that Einstein gave to his theory of gravity. And basically, the way it works is that gravity, you can think of it as an effect of space-time being curved by matter. So GR is not a quantum theory. It predicts exactly what's going to happen. There are no probabilities involved. And you can see already the issue. So GR is basically described by this one line. I'm not going to try to explain further, but it's a very simple equation. It looks it's compact, it's beautiful, but it's actually extremely complicated. So that's where all of black hole physics, all of cosmology, everything is included in this one line. So basically, T is matter, and R and G are the way space-time react to matter, and G is Newton's constant. So with GR, we can actually show that if you have an object that is very compact, very massive, it's going to evolve into a black hole. So if you take two shells of matter and let them fall into each other, you can show that after some time, an horizon will form and matter is included or surrounded by an horizon. I'll tell you what an horizon is in a second. So basically, gravity becomes so strong in the vicinity of these black holes that we can bend space-time dramatically. And basically, the idea is that when an object gets too close to this black hole, it gets past this horizon, there's a surface of no return, and you can never escape from this black hole. And this is what we call an horizon. It's not an object, it's just a place in space-time from which you cannot escape anymore. And there's one very famous way to explain this. Imagine you are on a river, and there's basically a waterfall around here. You're on a boat, and if you keep on going in that direction, at some point you'll pass the curve of no return from which you can't escape anymore. So think of a boat passing this curve of no return. At some point you'll try to put your engine on to try to fight the current of the river, but this will not work and you will eventually fall into the waterfall. So whatever you do, so you won't notice that you're passing this curve of no return, but once you've passed it, there's nothing you can do, you're going to fall into it. And black holes are very similar in that sense. When you pass the horizon of a black hole, you won't feel much. That's what GR tells us. Nothing dramatic happens, but you won't be able to escape anymore. And once you notice that you pass this horizon, it's too late. You're doomed. So now to the information paradox, which is how quantum mechanics and GR don't quite fit together. We can think of the following situation. We have two spheres of matter that are basically falling on each other. You form your black hole, and we've learned from Hawking that the black hole is actually not static. In a sense, it's going to start to emit particle, Hawking radiation, and after some time, the black hole will shrink and evaporate completely into radiation. And basically, there's no way from this radiation to reconstruct what fell into the black hole. So what happened to information? It has disappeared with the black hole, and that violates quantum mechanics. And that's basically one of the guidelines we have to try to merge the theories. So again, for theories, the black hole is the following. Schwarzschild black hole, at least, you have an horizon, and the horizon is given by the size of the horizon is given by 2 times Newton's constant, the mass of the black hole divided by the speed of light. And light can't escape from this horizon. So once you have passed this event horizon, you are in the black hole. And furthermore, we believe that we cannot see the singularity to be here. And in a sense, that's a good thing because we know that this singularity GR is going to break down. The force becomes so strong that we can't control it anymore, and we have to modify GR at some level. So black holes are black, but astronomers are very smart people. And they have found ways to probe black holes. So this is a movie that was taken over many years. So you see the timeline here of the center of our galaxy where we know there's a black hole. And the way astronomers look for black holes by following the path of stars around the black hole, which is corresponding to that cross here. And by studying the trajectory of stars, they can find out that there's something very massive that is black, and it's very heavy, and it's too heavy to be anything else but a black hole. So that's the way we can look for it. So recently, so I have to find out how to start this movie. Let's see. I'm going to keep it quiet. So another way to look for black hole is if you found a system with a star and a black hole not too far away. So this is a movie. It's not an actual it's a simulation, if you want. So that's a star, and stars can emit jets of matter. And if you had a black hole around it, you could see a black hole. So you could see how the black hole feeds on the star by absorbing some of the matter of the star. So we've seen last year with a radio telescope called ALMA, black holes feeding on gas. That is the interpretation we have. So we can see these kind of effects in real life. Now more recently, we have another strong evidence for the existence of black holes. You certainly have heard that gravitational waves were discovered. And this is a signal that you see. And the interpretation is that we had two black holes that were dancing together, basically inspiring together. And at some point, they merge. And we can, in the end of the day, have only one black hole that corresponds to the merger of these two original black holes. And the fact that the merger into, or the final phase of this merger goes very fast, and that calms down very fast, corresponding to one black hole, final black hole, is a sign of, it's a prediction of GR. So that fits very well with what we expect from GR and black holes. So here is a movie, again, a simulation of what we'd expect to happen based on GR. So you have your two black holes with different masses. For some, whatever reason, the movie is very slow on this computer. And you see that they spiral, getting closer to each other. And that part, we're not really testing GR. That's still Newtonian physics. But towards the last part of this animation, when they really merge into one final object, yeah, I think I'm going to give up. It's just going to take too long. Let's see if I can speed that up a little bit. So, yeah, okay, that was too fast. Right. Here we go. So we are really probing the strong regime of GR, and the prediction again of GR is that the actual phase of the merger should be extremely fast, and that's what we see with the waves that are emitted and seen by LIGO, emitted by the black hole and seen by LIGO. So that's one final black hole, and this happens very, very fast. So again, we have very strong evidences that black holes actually do exist. So now to the bad news. If you want to do quantum gravity, strong gravity, astrophysical black holes may not be the place to look for, because the larger the mass of the black hole, and the astrophysical black holes are very massive, the smaller the curvature of the horizon. And that essentially means that space-time is not very curved around the horizon of black holes. So if you want to look at high curvature, you have to go towards a singularity, and the high curvature is where we can study this unification of quantum mechanics in GR. But we can't see inside a black hole. So we have to look for light black holes. And the question how light could be a black hole. So the black holes I work on most of the time are objects that are very, very light, so 10 to minus 5 gram. It's difficult to imagine. But those are the ones where quantum gravity are really relevant. Primordial black holes that could be a part of dark matter maybe would have masses of something like 10 to the 14 gram. A stellar mass black hole, so those are the ones astronomers see, would have masses of the order of 10 to the 34 grams, so three solar masses. Now, we suspect there are many black holes in mass range of 100 to 10 to the 6 solar masses. And we see many supermassive black holes with masses of 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 10 solar masses. I mean, those are numbers that are just astronomical. And they're tough to imagine, but we know these things are there. So we have to look for lighter black holes if we want to do something interesting in terms of quantum gravity. So before getting into that, let me try to entertain the youngest people in the room. Traditionally, we thought that nothing to do, so I'm going to take you on a trip as you fall into a black hole. And traditionally, we thought that nothing too dramatic would happen as you cross the horizon. It's only when you get towards the singularity, so the center of the black hole, that gravity would become very strong and it would get stretched a little bit. And you can see that with this nice cartoon. So I'll try to cut the sound a little bit because it's going to be very loud otherwise. So let's see. So I don't know if you know Ren and Stimpy, but kids apparently do that. And so they're in a shuttle going towards the black hole. And they're worried for nothing, but at this point it starts to stretch a little bit. They become more of a spaghetti-like. And so that's a classical picture. You pass through the horizon. It's only when you get close to the singularity that you might suffer a little bit. Otherwise, you'll be fine. It's okay. Now that I've waking you up with this annoying sound, you can go on with something more serious. So one of the things we've realized in the past few years, though, is that the assumption that the horizon is smooth and nothing of particular happen might be wrong. And one way to get around this information paradox that I mentioned is to assume that something quite dramatic happened at the horizon and that you basically burn as you go through the horizon. And that's one of the things we hope to probe next few years with modern radio telescopes, basically. So there might be a major modification of GR at the horizon of black holes. So how can we probe the Planck scale, so this 10 to the 19 GeV I mentioned at the start of the talk with black holes? So first of all, we should think about what the Planck mass is. So I mentioned to you Newton's constant, h bar from quantum mechanics, and c from the speed of light. So the Planck mass is a ridiculously large number in terms of energy, 10 to the 19 GeV, so it's not so impressive in kilogram, but for us, it's a huge number. The Planck length is something like 10 to minus 35 meter, and again, you can just build this length using this constant we have in nature. And you have the time, the Planck time, that is very tiny, 10 to minus 44. Again, it's very difficult to imagine these numbers, but they're very tiny. So we usually assume that quantum gravity only becomes strong around these scales. But this is way too naive, and that's one of the things we've learned in the last 15 years. The Planck mass is actually a dynamical quantity. And the scale at which quantum gravity becomes strong is really an experimental question. We have models that allow us to lower the Planck mass, so this 10 to 19 GeV here, way down to a TeV, which is the energy probe at colliders nowadays, if, for example, we live with in a large extra-dimensional theory with a large volume. So we could be confined to a surface in space-time, gravity being allowed to propagate in these extra dimensions, and that would be one way to realize this idea. Or we could have several brains or so surfaces, and gravity could be just pick and happen to be weak on our brain. So those are open questions. Even if we live in four dimensions, if we don't have this crazy extra dimension, we've shown that you could have a dynamical Planck mass. And the Planck mass is really a coupling constant, and we know as a fact from experiments that some of the coupling constant can run fast sprinters, and we measure, for example, the strength of the coupling constant as a change of the energy. We see, so the lines are the theoretical prediction, and the dots here, the arrow, the bars are the data, and you have couplings that go slower as well. Well, Newton's constant is no exception, and when I started to work on that topic, I wanted to know what people had done. I googled Newton constant, and that's the first thing that came out. It's not very respectful to Sir Newton, by the way, to have his face under our feet, but it shows that theoretical ideas can lead to anything, even business ideas. I'm sure it's a former physics student who was behind this idea. Anyway, we could work out quite carefully that if we exchange two particles for gravitons, so if this force carrier for gravity, and take quantum effects into account, that the Planck mass could be lowered as well down to the scales that we probe at colliders or with cosmic rays. So we could look for small black holes at colliders, and that's what people have done. So we could make quite precise predictions for how these quantum black holes, these Planck black holes, would decay. So from quarks, would be formed from quarks, they would create it, they would decay into leptons and other quarks, for example. So the problem we have to face at colliders is that the typical collision is very messy. So you collide protons, and that would be, if you were in the pipe of the collider, the two protons collide and there's loads of stuff coming out. So if you want to be able to find these objects, you have to make precise calculations. And again, the idea is that we can use the concept of symmetries or patterns to make predictions like Gell-Mann had done for quarks. We have an eightfold wave for black holes. So that allows experimentalists, some of them at Sussex, to look for these black holes and set limits on the masses of this object. That's one paper that was using our results. So the thing that is amazing to me is that the start of the LHC could have been delayed because people were so worried that small black holes would be produced and actually swallow the Earth. So there was a guy who was trying to stop the CERN from starting his collision and went to talk to a judge in Hawaii, making the case that we could kill ourselves by studying the collider because we could build black holes. And that's what they had in mind. So that would be Geneva. So that would be the form of black hole that would start to swallow the Earth. And basically, these guys were very worried, and they tried to get a judge to forbid CERN from starting. Now, this is not so surprising, because in a country where people can try to get judged to stop anything. So anyway, that was the fear. And what we know, so physicists were actually very careful. Sorry, there's a mismatch in the movie. So I'm going to go back and forth. We know that if a black hole was produced in a collision of two particles, it would decay immediately back and forth, into objects, so it would not just sit there and swallow the Earth. So we had to do very careful studies for that. But what is really amazing to me is that CERN had to react at a time explaining that microscopic black holes would not eat you. So anyway, we were careful and nothing bad happened, but we haven't found black holes so far. As far as I know, the only place on Earth where we've seen black holes is in Belgium. So my wife is from Belgium, and we're driving around her parents' place, and well, here they have black holes. Apparently it's the name of a local beer. I haven't tried it, but it'd be very interesting. If you could get a bottle, let me know. And so far, Belgium has not exploded. And if they do, it'd be because of politics, not because of black holes. So anyway, hopefully I've convinced you that black holes are truly fascinating. We have observation of astrophysical black holes that confirm GR. As far as we know, it's a beautiful way to explain black holes. We can probe the scale of quantum gravity with black holes. Some of the tightest bands we're getting to date on this come from the Large Hadron Collider, and they're really the best way to look for a unification of quantum mechanics in GR. And there are lots of open questions. What happens when you pass the horizon? Is there a singularity? What happens to the formation? Thanks a lot for your attention.
As I'm sure you know, we don't take questions at Professor Electric, but I'm delighted to ask Tim Morris from the University of Southampton to ask a question.
Okay, so thank you very much, Xavier, for that wonderful lecture. It's my duty and my pleasure to give the vote of thanks. So Xavier, as we heard already from the Vice Chancellor, got his PhD at the University of Munich back in 2002. His supervisors were renowned researchers, Harold Fritsch and Julius Vest. And his first papers were very much in the world of what I would call standard particle physics. But it didn't take Xavier long to start walking on the wild side, some of which we've heard here. Already in 2001, in April of 2001, he wrote a paper which involved gravity and actually higher dimensions, which I don't think was something that you mentioned. Klutze-Klein theories, which involved the idea that we don't just have three space dimensions, but many more, possibly many more, but tightly curled up so that we can't see them. And in fact, a notable thing about that was that it was written without a supervisor. In fact, I noticed that he wrote many papers without a supervisor back then. He was also, and still is, very prolific, worked with other people or on his own and published on his own. And I find that in itself truly impressive. But racing to the present day, Xavier has established himself as an expert in quantum gravity, particularly black holes, as you've seen. And its implications for cosmology, astrophysics, and collider physics. He's been the leader of a quantum black holes section for European Network. He's written a couple of books with other authors on quantum black holes. He's written papers that have been picked out as notable by the journal in that particular year, received honorable mentions twice in a gravitation essay competition that's held every year, and I could go on, but what's notable about Xavier is to contrast his research with other workers in the field, including my own, actually. The research in gravity, in quantum gravity, as Xavier noted, it's still open how you put quantum mechanics and gravity together. And it's pursued, people attempt to find ways of doing that in many myriad ways. Asymptotic safety, string theory, non-commutative geometry, loop quantum gravity, spin foams, tensor field theory, causal sets, and so on. There are many. And for most of those, and I have to criticize myself in this respect as well, most of those researchers get so involved in the details that anything that looks like the real world seems very far off. What really picks out Xavier's research is his constant effort to make contact with experiments, with observations, and make predictions that people using telescopes or colliders can test. So I ask you to join me in giving a vote of thanks to Xavier for this wonderful inaugural lecture in the most appropriate way.